From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Should movies like Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, and The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover be rated X? Do we need a new rating that separates adult subject matter from pornography? Coming up, we ask these questions to people in the film industry on both sides of the issue. Also, we meet Michael Rooker. He's currently starring in the unrated film Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. He's also Tom Cruise's rival in the more mainstream movie Days of Thunder. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two new albums by Harry Connick Jr., and book critic John Leonard reviews three new books about the Salman Rushdie affair. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Foreign ministers of the Southeast Asian nations meeting in Jakarta said the continued influx of Vietnamese boat people has imposed an intolerable burden on countries in the region. The joint statement released at the meeting criticized the United States and Vietnam and said both countries have ignored an international plan agreed upon last year to resolve the problem. The BBC's Alexander Thompson has more from Jakarta.
Foreign ministers of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, in their statement on Vietnamese boat people, repeat their commitment to what's known as the Comprehensive Plan of Action agreed to at an international conference in Geneva last year. But that plan is wearing thin as countries in the region grow tired of the social, economic, and political burdens imposed by the boat people. And some countries, such as Malaysia, have already begun to push boat people away in defiance of the principle of first asylum. The ASEAN foreign ministers say measures must be stepped up to reduce the population of refugee camps in the region by resettlement and repatriation. And they regret that while countries in the region have been pressured to continue to provide first asylum, Vietnam and the United States have chosen to ignore fundamental elements of the Comprehensive Plan of Action.
Alexander Thompson in Jakarta. The U.S. Department of Education today intervened to help the nation's largest guarantor of student loans cover millions of dollars in bad debts. The government's action should keep the Kansas-based Higher Education Assistance Foundation solvent and should reassure other banks and small lending institutions that it's still safe to lend students money. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Department of Education officials have known that the Higher Education Assistance Foundation, HEAF, had incurred a growing number of bad loans every year for the last 4 years. But when HEAF's default rate shot up to 21% earlier this year, the foundation told banks and other lenders it could no longer promise it could repay millions of dollars in loan defaults. Education Department officials were pressured to make their intentions about the matter public today after rumors of the foundation's collapse began to spread. Education Secretary Lauro Cavazos today said the problem was serious but denied it threatened the government's student loan program.
This situation will not affect the ability of students to obtain loans, or lenders to make those loans, or guarantors to insure those loans.
Because the Department of Education is the ultimate guarantor of federal student loans, it must either save HEAF from collapse or find someone else to guarantee that lenders will get their money back. HEAF officials say the foundation has $300 million in bad loans pending. I'm Claudio Sanchez reporting.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 18 points to close at 2,922.28. Advances and declines were about even in active trading of 182 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Several of this year's most talked about art house movies were given an X rating from the Motion Picture Association of America. The X rating has come under fire from film directors and distributors who say the X has become a form of economic censorship. Many theaters won't show X-rated films. Some newspapers won't advertise them. Miramax, an independent film distributor, sued the Motion Picture Association of America over its X rating of their film Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down. Last week, New York State Court Judge Charles Ramos upheld the X rating, but criticized the classification system, calling it an effective form of censorship. An X means no one under 17 admitted, usually because of explicit sex or extreme violence. Critics of the classification system say although X was intended to indicate adult subject matter, the X-rated films have come to be regarded as pornography. They blame this in part on the fact that the X is the only MPAA rating that was never copyrighted. This allowed the pornography industry to advertise their films as X-rated, a real selling point for hardcore porn. A growing number of people in the film industry advocate a new rating, A for adult, to differentiate between pornography and more serious films. A little later, we'll hear from the head of marketing for Miramax, and we'll talk with Wayne Wang, whose new movie was just given an X. But first, we call Jack Valenti, the founding president of the Motion Picture Association of America. The rating system was created under his direction 22 years ago. I asked Valenti to respond to Judge Ramos's criticisms of the rating system.
If the judge had done his homework, he would have found that I invented that rating system to prevent government from interfering in the freedom of expression of creative filmmakers. Under the Supreme Court decision of 1968, it is perfectly legitimate and legal, and it's not tormenting to the Constitution, for states and counties or cities to organize their own rating and classification boards. And I thought, my God, if we have that take place, you would have a chaos in the marketplace. You would have hundreds of boards coming into being, all of whom would be making judgments about movies. It would be cacophony would be the norm, and we'd be drowning in a tangle of confusion. So I determined that we should have freedom of the screen, and so I junked all the old production codes that my predecessors had put in. And we invented a rating system, totally voluntary. No one has to submit their picture. No one has to cut 1 millimeter of their film. And all we did was to give advance cautionary warnings to parents saying, you should find out more about this film before you allow your child to see it.
Let me quote something else from this recent decision. The judge said the Motion Picture Association of America, having acquiesced in the use of the X rating by the pornography industry, may well have some affirmative responsibility to avoid stigmatizing films with an X rating. So what they're saying is since pornography has been using the X to describe its films, anyone who gets an X now, people will see it as being pornography.
Well, let
me ask you, one of the reasons why that's happened, I think, is because the X, unlike the PG or the R, was never copyrighted by the MPAA. And it was used, it was usurped by the pornography industry. Why did that happen?
Well, first, if the judge had done his homework, he'd realize there hasn't been a pornography picture submitted to the rating system for years. Number two, the theater that shows pornographic pictures is practically extinct. Hardcore porn pictures go into video, home video. They don't go to theaters now. And number three, I don't know of any X-rate, pornography pictures that use X. They use triple X, hot, steamy, wow, erotic. And they have all sorts of descriptions which tell people what's in their movie. They don't want just X. X to the rating system means for adults only. You see, the rating system is being made a patsy for a few publicity wizards. There are only about 5 or 6, maybe 10 films that are causing all this furor, and they're causing it because they realize that National Public Radio wouldn't be interviewing me if they hadn't gone to the press and screamed about their X rating. They're getting a lot of publicity, doing a lot of business, and you're going to see a lot more of these pictures. That these are small pictures where the distributor doesn't want to spend any money on advertising. So he says, how can I make my picture known? I know what I'll do. I'll kick the rating system in the backside. I'll scream censorship. And then I'll get on all the morning TV shows, and I'll be interviewed on National Public Radio. And I think, I don't want to sound pejorative. I want to laud these publicity people because I think they've done a superlative job.
Well, what many filmmakers and distributors are saying now is that there needs to be a distinction between a film that is X-rated because it is pornographic and a film that shouldn't be seen by children because it is adult in subject matter, but it's not just a pornographic film. And many of the films in question now, like Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, Wayne Wang's new movie Life is Cheap, are the films that this controversy is centering around. What do you think of the A rating?
Well, I don't think anything of it at all, because the A rating tells the rating board, now you must now make a distinction between two adults-only categories. You must say that this film is an artistic adults-only film, And this film is a non-artistic film. That is, you must make a judgment and say that this kind of bestiality, necrophilia, incest, mind-twisting violence is artistic, and this is not. We can't do that. The rating board cannot, must not, make quality judgments. The presumption of quality in a picture is left to film critics and to audiences, because once we start making judgments about what is artistic or what is tasteful, the taste that resides in the movie or its singular vacancy, that's the moment in which the rating board becomes a movie review. And I suspect that the Society of Film Critics would rise in outrage over this usurpation of their territorial imperative, and guess what? I would support them. Indulging in value and quality assumptions is not the role of the rating board, nor can it be.
When you decided to form the classification system, why did you decide to have the jury be a jury of parents? And I'm wondering how those parents are chosen.
Well, nothing mysterious. They're just people who are parents. We don't want psychiatrists and psychologists because, frankly, it depends on what psychiatrist and psychologist you have. You know, if you go into a courtroom today and somebody's being tried for murder, the prosecution brings in a psychiatrist and says this man is competent to stand trial. The defense brings in a psychiatrist and says, no, he's crazy. So psychiatrists never agree, neither do psychologists. So we said we wanted people to make judgments that other parents would feel was an accurate depiction of this picture, so giving them some advance cautionary warning so they could find out more about this film. Now, when we say people, so only parents should be doing that, because parents are parents, and parents are the ones to whom this entire rating system is directed and for whom it was designed.
But parents are as subjective as psychiatrists, certainly, and you could find parents representing every view on the entire spectrum of any issue you could come up with, probably.
Well, that's right. So what is the alternative?
What are they told in how to evaluate movies? What kind of preparation are they given?
Their preparation is, as a parent, what kind of a rating do you think a parent ought to have? What do you think is a rating that a parent would think would be an accurate rating? There is no way to have do's and don'ts. As a matter of fact, the first thing I did when I took this post was to junk the production code, which literally had 40 pages of do's and don'ts. You can't do open-mouth kissing. If two people are in bed, each of them have to have a foot on the floor, which means you got to be Nadia Comaneci if you're going to do more than affectionately smile at somebody. This is stupid. You can't have do's and don'ts for creative movies. You can shoot a scene 40 different ways. So there is no objective thing. What is too much violence? Is it a fist fight? Is it the cattle rustler killing the sheriff? Is it John Wayne hitting the beaches at Iwo Jima? Is it okay to kill 20 people in a machine gun nest, but wrong to kill one person on the street? I mean, what is too much violence? I think psychologists have wrestled with this question. The Supreme Court can't even define what pornography is. So all of this is totally subjective. So we have one criterion, and that is, rate this film as a parent might feel is an accurate rating for this film. And that's the criterion that we use.
What kind of parents are on there? How are they chosen? And I'm thinking there's so many different kinds of communities around the country.
Well, we only have 11 people on this panel. Obviously, it's not a microcosm of 240 million people. The California Parent Teachers Association offers names. People write in. Sometimes the teacher is going to take a sabbatical leave and would like to serve on the board. There's nothing mysterious about it. We try to choose people who are parents and who like movies and would like to serve on the board. We interview them. We don't accept them all. We accept some.
What standards do you use, though, to choose which parents make it on?
Well, we have no standard. We interview people and talk to them. That's what standards we use. We don't have a do's and don'ts for it.
But what kind of balance is there between
parents? Well, we got
parents,
blacks, we got whites, we got males, we got females. But you can't have, there are only seven full-time members and four part-time members. Now, if you can tell me how you can assess quotas on that, then you're a better man than I am, Gunga Din.
Because of this controversy about the classification system, and it's under attack by some filmmakers and distributors, and the judge in this recent decision questioned the classification system. What are your fears now about what might happen? What are your concerns?
I have no concerns. I think the rating system is doing just fine. And as a matter of fact, that we take a poll every year by the Opinion Research Corporation of Princeton, New Jersey. In the last decade, we've found that 70 to 74% of parents with young children find this rating system very useful to fairly useful in helping them decide their children's movie going. Some 20 to 24% find it not useful. So the constituency to whom we are directed is supportive of this system. And I'm not going to let three or four distributors and maybe a dozen films out of the 10,000 that we have rated force us to do things that I think are wrong.
Jack Valenti is the president of the Motion Picture Association of America. We'll hear from the other side of the issue after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Miramax Films is the distribution company that took the MPAA to court over the X rating of their film Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down. Russell Schwartz is the senior vice president of marketing for Miramax. Two other Miramax films received X ratings this year, The Cook, the Thief, His Wife and Her Lover, and Hardware. Russell Schwartz wants the MPAA to add an A rating to their classification system for films that have adult content but aren't pornography.
There's a problem with the perception of what X is in this country. And there's a problem that the MPAA seems to be digging its feet in and not making what I would feel is a very, very simple change in the rating system, and then all this flap would go away.
How does an X rating affect your ability to distribute a movie?
We have found that the X rating has a significant impact on the way we are allowed to release the films, and that begins from newspapers around the country who did not necessarily take ads or on a case-by-case basis. While they don't necessarily have any blanket policy about not accepting X-rated ads, they certainly look at every ad and decide whether they even want to take the advertising. Any kind of broadcast, whether it's independent stations or networks, will not take X-rated movie ratings, whether they even if they go out unrated. We have been able to get some of the ads for these two pictures on cable, but it is certainly it's a much smaller audience than when we wanted to get the advertising going. Many theaters throughout the country have real estate clauses in their contracts with the real estate owners of the shopping malls, or many theaters, as you know, are in. They're not allowed to run X-rated films, and it goes on and on and on.
What's the difference between having a film go unrated and the film having an X?
You have a little more latitude in terms of theaters that will play the picture. Some exhibitors will say that they will play the film unrated, even though it may have gotten an X rating, but still, the ultimate net effect might be the same. You're still dealing with a film that has gotten publicity as an X rating, and you are still tied to the same problems that you have whether the film kept the X at all. We could not go out with an X-rated picture. There was just no way that we could do it. The only recourse that we have as an independent is to go out unrated, but that is not what we want.
You're an advocate of creating a new rating, A, for adult. What would A signify?
Well, I'm an advocate for creating a new rating or for eliminating the X entirely and just replacing it. I mean, both of those are fine for us. The A rating would be to reinstate the X rating as to what it was when it was originally introduced by the MPAA 20 years ago. That's when films that were mainstream Hollywood pictures, like Midnight Cowboy, which went on to win an Academy Award for Best Foreign Film for Best Picture of the Year, went out with an X rating. And at that point, X meant that this is a film that should not be seen by children under 17, even with an adult. And but it was still a legitimate category. It was a legitimate rating. By not copyrighting the letter, the MPAA has allowed that rating to be co-opted by the pornographers, has allowed it to be bastardized, and it therefore has become to mean something other than what the original intention was. An A rating would either restore the integrity of what the initial idea of the X was and let people know that this is a serious film, albeit not a pornographic one, or if one got rid of the X and replaced it with an R plus or whatever letter or an A letter. I somehow don't think the MPAA would allow us to, would institute an A letter for this, but whatever the letter may be, It would get it back to what it was meant to be when it was initially started.
Jack Valenti, the head of the Motion Picture Association of America, has said that he doesn't want to have to make qualitative decisions between, for instance, an X or an A. He doesn't want to have to distinguish between artistic bestiality and exploitative bestiality. He thinks that that's a difficult, if not impossible, thing to do and not something that his group ought to be doing. What do you think?
I think it's nonsense. I think he's doing it already. He's already differentiating between G, PG, PG-13, and R. He was willing to differentiate between R and X. The problem is now that studios have only one adults category to release their pictures under, which is R, since none of them will go out X. So R has become in itself a bastardized letter. What was meant to be two categories is now only one. So look at what R rating means now. R is the wastebasket that everything gets put into. And you've got so many variations of R-rated movies now that I can't believe that was the intent. 5 years ago, when there was no PG-13, all of a sudden the MPAA, you know, with their member powers and the member studios, came up with a letter, PG-13, that differentiated between PG and R. So I don't see what the problem is going between R and X, if X must stay.
Would you like to see the classification system removed altogether?
I've been thinking about that, but at this point I do feel that there's a need for a system. I do feel that an advisory system is necessary. I just think it has to be one that's updated to our times.
You've questioned the X rating within the classification system. What are your opinions of who sits in judgment on the films, the panel of parents?
Well, that in itself is a pretty interesting group. We don't know how they're appointed. We don't know who they are. I don't know what the tenure is of the parents in Los Angeles. I don't know how long they are in, how long they're out. I don't know whether I don't know what the lobbying efforts that go on inside the system. It's a very, very private system. And for a system that supposedly polices itself, it certainly seems very closed in terms of people like us who are trying to get some information about how it's done, getting any information.
Do you think that certain kinds of films are more likely to be singled out for an X?
I think maybe it's easier for the MPAA to look at independent films and say that these films could be more harshly rated, precisely because they know we have the ability to go out unrated. So it's easier for them to give us the X rating, and we go out with the R rating, and the system stays intact. That cannot happen with a studio or with a member company. So I think there's perhaps a little more feeling that the independent distributors, I don't know, all of a sudden there's been so many films that have come out, not just from Miramax, but from other countries, other companies that are also receiving our X ratings, and it's just a curious fact of our times, I guess.
In one of the larger companies, they wouldn't allow a film to go out with an X.
They can't.
What does that mean, they can't?
They can't. No, they can't go out with an X rating because they have the same problems. They would run into the same problems that we do. Advertising, theater selection, public perception. No, they just can't. It's just impossible for them.
So they'll just recut a movie until it gets the R.
Right, right. Which is in itself a whole question that it certainly puts them at odds with the creative community, I think. And that will become more and more intense. And I do believe there'll be more battles on maybe a more mainstream level that will be heating up. I mean, every day there seems to be some director or some writer, some group that is calling for a relook at the system. And I think it's becoming obvious from Mr. Valenti's own peers that there's a system that needs to be overhauled. The system is just as much of a system that works or doesn't work for the people that it was made to police, i.e. the creative community and Hollywood itself, as much as it was, as it is, as a guideline for parents. It's not the innocent, benign guideline for parents that he keeps saying it is. It's much more important than that. It's a much bigger thing than that. Much bigger issues that are raised here than just a simplistic guideline.
Russell Schwartz of Miramax Films. Wayne Wang is one of the latest film directors to get an X rating. For his film, Life is Cheap, but Toilet Paper is Expensive. Wang also directed the films Chan is Missing, Dim Sum, Slam Dance, and Eat a Bowl of Tea. I asked him about the scenes in his new film that got the X rating.
The first one, is a shot of our main character flipping through a porno magazine. Actually, it's a magazine called A Poppin' Mamas. They're actually pregnant women, which is, you know, readily available in the market, you know, everywhere. Two is a shot of our main character at the end of the film where he's punished and he's being forced to eat feces. And three is a shot of one of the bad guys in the film talking on a mobile telephone while he's going to the bathroom. And four is a violent shot of actually an arm getting cut off, which in our film is actually used as a dream sequence.
And I should say that the scene of the man relieving himself on the toilet, there's no nudity, it's the sound that I think they probably objected to.
Well, it's the sound, and you actually do see some excrement coming out, but it's all blocked by subtitles. But one thing, I mean, I can explain all these different reasons and why we wanted to do them. I mean, one of the big things about that particular instance, a guy in a bathroom talking on a mobile telephone and then relieving himself, is because mobile telephone is so obnoxious in Hong Kong. Everybody has it. You know, no matter where you go, you see guys with their, you know, mobile telephone. And in Hong Kong, a lot of the bathrooms are still the old primitive squat style bathroom. So here you see a guy squatting to go to the bathroom and with this modern technology talking on the phone. So I just thought it's a very, you know, appropriate comment on Hong Kong.
When you were given an idea of what the problems were in the film, the perceived problems that gave you an X, did you consider removing those scenes or toning them down?
Well, no, because I think it's very important when we made the film, we made it in a no-nonsense, straightforward way to show exactly some of the things we saw in Hong Kong. And to take them out or tone them down would completely, you know, change the film or destroy the film. For example, the scene where the hero of our movie is being punished and he has to eat, feces, that's a very crucial scene in a movie. If we took it out, I mean, it wouldn't mean anything, because the whole point of the scene is that, you know, these gangsters in Hong Kong use this as a way to punish somebody, and it's so ridiculous. I mean, and they do it in the name of honor. And, you know, it's a black comedy that satirizes that. So we took it out, then that scene would have actually no meaning at all.
What was it about the subject of this film that got you in a direction that landed you with an X rating?
Yeah, one of the things that kind of got me more freer and more opened up in terms of what I wanted to show on screen was in the making of Eat a Bowl of Tea. There's sort of like very subtle censorship from like a big studio movie in that they say, well, you know, we want a lot of audience to see this film, so we want to keep it sort of PG-13. And in that way, it's almost like there are a lot of things you can't do automatically. And there's kind of a feeling and frustration from that I felt, I wanted to just to be free of any kind of censorship and be able to do a film that talked about, you know, sex and violence, so to speak.
Jack Valenti, who's the head of the MPAA, says it's really not their place to distinguish between art and pornography. Or to quote him, he says, do you want us to distinguish between artistic bestiality and non-artistic bestiality? I mean, would you be happy investing the rating code people with that power to determine what's pornography and what's art?
I wouldn't actually. but I think there are some simple things that you can look at very clearly. I think, you know, instead of like just looking at the scene and say this is sex, you know, maybe there's a way of looking at the fuller content and the intent of the film overall. And there are going to be lines of ambiguity, and those are the things that I think needs to be discussed to see if there is a way of finding, you know, a better way to categorize an A film.
That's film director Wayne Wang. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air, and this is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet Michael Rooker, star of Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, and co-star of Days of Thunder. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two new records by Harry Connick Jr. The 1989 death threat against Salman Rushdie shook the world. Now there are three new books about it. John Leonard has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has called on the U.S. Senate to move political passion aside as it considers his nomination of Appeals Court Judge David Souter to the U.S. Supreme Court. The president made his comments during a meeting with state Republicans in Pennsylvania. Christian Viancor of member station WHYY has more from Philadelphia.
The president opened his remarks by explaining his nomination of Judge David Souter for Senate confirmation to fill the seat vacated by Justice William Brennan.
There was no single issue, no litmus test or standard dominating my decision to nominate. And I will add, there should be no litmus test in the process of confirmation.
Bush then went on to endorse the Pennsylvania state Republican candidates, including abortion rights candidate Barbara Hafer, who is trying to oust Democratic Governor Robert Casey, who sides with anti-abortion activists. For National Public Radio, this is Christiane Viancor in Philadelphia.
The court-appointed trustee of Eastern Airlines announced today that a federal grand jury in New York will indict the airline on charges of conspiracy and maintenance violations. Trustee Martin Shagrew announced that attempts to work out a deal between the U.S. Attorney's Office and the airline had broken down. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
At a news conference this afternoon, Martin Shagrew, who has been running Eastern Airlines for 3 months, said that negotiations between Eastern's lawyers and the federal attorney's office broke off over the question of conspiracy. Shagrew said that Eastern was willing to plead guilty to maintenance violations, but said a conspiracy charge would call into question the entire airline's current maintenance program, which he described as superior, and would have put under question all employees and managers involved with it.
We cannot and will not plead guilty to violations of the law for which we find no evidence. The U.S. Attorney's Office has offered us no evidence of systemic wrongdoing.
A grand jury has reportedly been looking into allegations that Eastern altered and falsified maintenance and safety records at airports in New York and Atlanta. Andrew Maloney, the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, declined to comment on whether an indictment was imminent. I'm Margot Adler in New York.
American Airlines has given up its plan to add fare surcharges at 5 airports starting August 1st. The airline dropped its plan to add surcharges of up to $4 a ticket after other U.S. airlines declined to do the same. Airports that would have been affected by the plan were Palm Beach and Fort Myers in Florida, New York's LaGuardia, Newark Airport in New Jersey, and the airport in New Orleans. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up close to 18 points to close at 2,922.28 on volume of some 182 million shares. Advancing issues edged out declines. This is
Fresh Air. Coming up, we have an interview with actor Michael Rooker. But first, since Harry Connick Jr.'s debut album 2 years ago, the young singer and pianist has become a media darling. Last summer, he sang on the soundtrack of the movie When Harry Met Sally. This summer, he's on the road with a big band, and in the fall, he'll be appearing in his first on-screen movie role. But one person who's not impressed is our jazz critic, Kevin Whitehead.
Harry Connick Jr. really gets on my nerves. It's not just the arrogant way he conducts himself in interviews, like in a recent one where he said that Max Roach, the most open-minded of jazz veterans, was over the hill. It's not even the hype that's been heaped on him, although that helps. And it's not that I'm always hearing about how cute he is. I have to live with that problem myself. No, for me, the trouble with Harry is his music, especially now that he's got two new albums out. One showcases his piano playing, the other his vocals. Let's take the piano album first. It's called Lofty's Roach Soufflé. Harry Connick thanks 36 people in his new album's liner notes. His parents, his manager, his publicists, his tailors. But he doesn't mention Thelonious Monk, which is really strange since his piano style is such a blatant Monk ripoff. Well, to be fair, he doesn't sound exactly like Monk. He sounds more like Monk trying to play piano with his arms in plaster casts. Connick reproduces Monk's mannerisms without understanding what made his style work, his unerring sense of rhythm. Where Monk's chords bounced along at unpredictable intervals, Connick and his rhythm section sound like they're slogging through mud. Well, I could trash this record all day, but it's time to move on to the other one.
It's a recipe for making love. It doesn't need sugar, cause it's already sweet. It doesn't need an oven, cause it's got a lot of heat. Just add a dash of kisses to make it all complete. And that's the recipe for making love.
If there was no such word as cutesy poopsky, they'd have to coin it for that number. It's from Connick's big band vocal album called We Are in Love. The number you just heard is one of 6 tunes on the album Connick wrote for the movie Dick Tracy, although they weren't used. Like the movie itself, they have an ersatz old-fashioned flavor. As with his Monk impersonation, you can hear what he's aiming at, but the parts don't quite fit right.
I know you so well. I can't tell by the sound of your voice if you're really in love with me. And you are. And you are. You know I can't lie. If I say to you, baby, I love you, then baby, I love you. Oh, and I do. Yes, I do. I do. Could it be that's a phrase you thought never would faze you? Well, baby, you better hold on tight. I'm the one who's supposed to kneel down and propose. Well, all right. Ooh, I might do so.
Those violins add a certain extra something, like when you pour maple syrup over ice cream. You can tell Connick's trying to do a Frank Sinatra, from his vibrato, the way he forms his vowels, and his smarmy attitude. But listening to him try to pull a Frank is like seeing a little boy dressed up in one of his father's suits. You might find it amusing, but you wouldn't mistake it for a good fit. A big part of the problem is that the lyrics Connick sings make him sound like he's free associating.
Later on, good wishes. Later on, good try. I'm afraid won't do, it's not justified. You go from the privy. end up deprived.
That's like some surrealist's parody of a romantic lyric. Stuff like that makes me suspect Connick is actually some cunning performance artist who's lampooning what he pretends to stand for. I mean, really, a cross between Frank Sinatra and Thelonious Monk? Connick's defenders will tell you he's helping young people discover jazz. But he's not doing Monk any favors by making a travesty of his style, and Connick's bubblegum big band has nothing to do with swing music's best instincts. These albums are so awful, they're guaranteed to get Grammy nominations.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. This is Fresh Air. You can see Michael Rooker in two very different roles this summer. He plays Tom Cruise's car racing mentor in Days of Thunder, and he stars as Henry in the disturbing psychodrama Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. Rooker has played other sinister movie characters. In Eight Men Out, he was a bribe-taking baseball player. In Mississippi Burning, he was a vicious Klansman. And in Sea of Love, he was the psychopathic repairman. I asked Michael Rooker if it seems ironic to be simultaneously starring in a mainstream big-budget action film and an independent low-budget drama that was initially rated X.
Yeah, it does, and especially since we did Henry probably about 5 years ago. And it's very unusual for something to go away like that and to come back and get positive reviews.
Did you ever think that movie was going to come back and haunt you?
Oh, yeah, a lot of times. You never know, you know. I mean, you do things, and it's early on in your career, and it was just the wrong time 5 years ago, and it came back, and people were ready for it. Some people were, anyway.
When you thought that the movie might come back and haunt you, what were the types of things you'd worry about?
Well, casting, mainly.
Yeah.
Future work.
You would have been better known, but you would have been typecast.
Well, I don't know if I would have been better known, but I would have been definitely typecast more than I was. And as it is, I mean, Sea of Love, Mississippi Burning, those aren't quite the kind of
nice guy roles
you'd
yeah.
want to marry, you know?
Yeah.
So
let me ask you some more things about the other film that's showing now of yours, Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. When I interviewed the director of Henry, I told him that I really liked the way you'd played Henry, because here you were playing a sociopath with no capacity for feelings, but you played it in this low-key, introverted way that made it easy for, like, the girlfriend character in the movie to interpret you as being, having wounded sensitivity.
As long as I can remember, she'd be bringing men up to the house. My daddy was there, too, but it didn't matter nothing to her. And she'd make me watch it.
It's creepy.
She beat me, too, a lot. She beat me when I wouldn't watch it. And sometimes she beat me and make me wear a dress and watch her doing it. Then they'd laugh at me.
She made you wear a dress?
You think I'm lying?
I feel like I know you. Like I've known you for a long time. I feel like I've known you forever and ever.
The director said that that was your idea, that that was all your interpretation. So I'm interested in the insights you had into this character that led you to play it in this kind of way where this sociopath lacking emotions could be interpreted as being really sensitive.
He wasn't a big talker, you know. He had a lot of problems. It was almost as if it was anti-acting. It was completely opposite of what I had done in school, and so it was a major problem for me to sort of figure out a way to do this guy that would would not be some crazy loony, you know. And I'd seen some interviews with the real person, and it reminded me of my dad, really, who was a very soft-spoken man, very gentle and not very aggressive person. And but when the kids were doing something wrong or something, his voice would, you know, get very firm and very stern at times. It just gave me a feeling of, I mean, that's just the way it, that's the only way it could have been done. I felt the guy had been lobotomized, basically, emotionally, totally lobotomized, and there was not much there.
Every role I've seen you in, I think, you've played someone from a working class background, and I was wondering what kind of background you're from.
Well, I'm working class, but below working class, you know. Whatever. I grew up in Alabama until I was 13, and it was what they call down there is being on the wrong side of the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all the poor people, basically. You know, all the people living on welfare and getting government subsidies or whatever, you know. Yeah, the people who can't, who don't, a lot of times don't even have jobs, but try to make do the best way they know how. And my dad and the people that I grew up with were like miners and truck drivers and stuff like that. And by the time I moved to Chicago, it was just me and my my mom and my five sisters. So we grew up on the Nelson Algren's neighborhood, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really?
Milwaukee Division, Ashland. And went to school at Wells High School, where it was very popular to drop bowling balls from the third floor. Back, I don't know if they're still doing it, but back then it was kind of rough school. And I sort of hid in the corner until I could get into the class or something.
Well, were you picked on at all for being the Southerner moved north?
Oh, when I first got here, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's major culture shock.
Yeah, what did you have to adjust to?
Well, basically, I had this accent that you couldn't even understand. And my hair was always cut short. And I was a real skinny kid. So I just looked very funny. And people just felt like, hey, come over here. I want to punch you in the nose. And I wouldn't allow them to do that. But it was, I blend in. I try to blend in as quickly as possible. I mean, it was rough there for a while.
Did you know how to fight?
Well, yeah. I learned very quickly. Yeah.
Did you have racial adjustments you had to make moving from the South to the North?
As a matter of fact, I did. I mean, all I knew was where I was. I mean, there were no black people or Spanish people or any other kind of races involved in my hometown. It was just very white, very very poor, you know, just kind of small town thing. And the black people lived over in a whole different part of town, which was basically their own town. You know, they had their own swimming pools, their own schools. And so I never had any kind of social involvement with black people until I moved to Chicago.
And what was that like? I mean, were you distrusting initially?
I guess I must have come at a very, very pivotal time. I got here and we moved, and basically it was almost an all-black neighborhood. So it was meant to be, you know. So I got there, and the school was, I think it was called, I forget the name of the school. But it was mostly black, the reason we moved there was because basically we couldn't afford anywhere else, you know. And eventually that stuck in my mind. These black people are just like me. We can't afford anything. They can't afford anything. They bleed. I bleed. When I punch them, they punch me. I bleed too. We're the same. And I had lots of fights there. Primarily because of who I was and the attitude I had, you know.
What attitude?
Well, I mean, I didn't know any black people.
Yeah.
And just never socialized with them. And it was a problem when I first arrived.
For some people, for some men, acting would seem to go against the kind of macho image that they wanted to have. I think this was especially true a few years ago when you would have been coming of age. I wonder if you ever had reservations like that when you were young and thinking that acting might be interesting.
Well, I thought acting would be interesting, but it was not the thing to do. It was not work, basically. It was not work. You know, coming from the background I came from, people, you know, miners and truck drivers and people who really get their hands dirty and work hard, like 14, 15-hour days, you know, come home dirty and smelly and sweaty and everything. This acting had nothing to do with that. And so, I steered away from it for a long time. I didn't really I found what I really loved to do and my dream, you know, what I desired to do all my life, and never really had the guts or the ego to really pursue. And that started occurring probably in my early 20s.
As someone who's starring in one movie that has some really interesting, very disturbing scenes in it, I'm wondering if when you were young, if there were any movies you saw that were very disturbing and you loved, that really stuck with you.
No, there were almost no movies I saw when I was young that I loved. I didn't see any very good movies at all until I was in my late teens when I started meeting and hanging out with theater people in junior college there. Most of the time when we went to the movie house, the folks would take the kids and drop us off. And it didn't matter what was playing. They just drop us off, we go in. And it was usually Abbott and Lou Costello meets Frankenstein or something like that. You know, or Godzilla movie or, you know, that kind of stuff. That's what I grew up on, Three Stooges stuff. And they were good. I mean, it was fun. I like that. I like that kind of comedy, very physical comedy and stuff. But I never saw myself doing that as an actor or anything like that. And it never even occurred to me to do that kind of thing.
Well, Michael Rooker, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michael Rooker stars in Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, and Days of Thunder. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, will you have any more on Judge Souter, President Bush's nominee for the Supreme Court?
Yes, we'll hear from NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg today about the decision to choose Judge Souter. How did they arrive at him? It seems that very conservative Republicans really wanted somebody else. We'll hear why President Bush chose Judge Souter. Also, we'll talk with Governor Judd Gregg of New Hampshire a little bit about Judge Souter, a man who lives a little bit down the road from him and whom he's known for a number of years. Also, another judicial story today, Terry. We're going to recall a U.S. Appeals Court ruling of 50 years ago this week, which made it legal to play records on the radio.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There are three new books out about author Salman Rushdie and the controversy over his novel The Satanic Verses. Book critic John Leonard has this review of The Rushdie File, The Rushdie Affair, and Salman Rushdie Sentenced to Death.
These three books tell us what happened all over again, from the publishing of The Satanic Verses in London, to the burning of it in Bradford, to the rioting about it in Islamabad, to the banning of it throughout the Muslim world, to the Ayatollah's bloodthirsty fatwa and the $5 million price tag on Salman Rushdie's head. Daniel Pipes, director of Philadelphia's Foreign Policy Institute, wants us to understand the Muslim mind. They take their religion so seriously, they didn't even have to read the novel to be offended by the title, which Pipes back-translates from Arabic, Persian, and Turkish into a literal English, which, by extrapolation and simplification, could be said to mean the Koran was written by Satan, or the Satanic Koran, fighting words. Besides, says Pipes, Rushdie is an immature and spoiled intellectual who brought his own troubles on himself because of his fashionable leftism, his third-worldist anti-Americanism, and the profound political irresponsibility of his position as a writer in opposition. W.J. Weatherby, U.S. correspondent for The Guardian, wants us to understand the novelist's mind. Rushdie is Indian immigrant and self-doubting egotist. An actor at Cambridge with David Hare and Germaine Greer. An ad copywriter in London with Faye Weldon. Sued by Indira Gandhi because of his first novel. Banned in Pakistan by Zia because of his second. In hiding and deserted by his wife because of the third. The Rushdie File, the last volume, is an anthology of almost everything anybody had to say on the subject. From Egypt's Nobel laureate Naguib Mahfouz, who called Khomeini a terrorist, to New York's Cardinal O'Connor, who promised he wouldn't read the book and encouraged other Catholics not to. Special attention is also paid in the anthology to the gutless wonders, those Western writers like John le Carré, who left Rushdie twisting in the wind. I prefer Weatherby because his book has a tragic shape. Rushdie, the immigrant from Islam to modernism, bastard child of history and doubt, between identities, a one-man culture shock, prophesied himself the whirlpool and the assassins. I'm least happy with Pipes. While we try to understand the Muslim mind, I wish Muslims dwelling in the West would try as hard to understand us and our free speech fetish. Nor, after reading a million words on Rushdie, do I believe Pipes when he says the title caused the fuss. To Pipes, I'd quote a famous line from Fran Lebowitz. People have been cooking for thousands of years, so if you are the very first to have thought of adding fresh lime juice to scalloped potatoes, try to understand there must be a reason for this. Mostly I'm disappointed. Not so much with the politicians in India, Pakistan, and England, who behaved as usual like unprincipled opportunists. And not just with the John le Carrés and V.S. Naipauls who caved in to terrorist literary criticism, but especially with Western religious leaders. You'll look in vain in these three books for a single word on Rushdie's behalf from the Vatican, or the Archbishop of Canterbury, or the chief rabbis of the United Hebrew congregations in the British Commonwealth and the Ashkenazis in Israel. All of them deplored the book. Overnight, they forgot about Erasmus and Spinoza, Jan Hus and Thomas More, Galileo and Martin Luther, not to mention Jesus Christ, free speech on the cross.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Rushdie File from Syracuse University Press, Daniel Pipes' The Rushdie Affair, and W.J. Weatherby's Salman Rushdie, Sentenced to Death. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tui and Rossanne Bucci.